question earlier.
Yeah, let me just check if there is anyone on the phone that wants to give an oral comment, then we'll have time remaining.
Well, you got a lot of time. Next jet's at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
So, operator, is there anyone on the line that is queued up to give a public comment?
There are currently no questions in the queue.
Okay. All right, just let me know if that changes. I guess you had a question.
So one of your slides you have.
So actually, let me just close down, just for the reporter. We're going to close down the comments in the room unless anybody said gone, if anybody wanted to fill out a card. But we'll just close public comments and continue with questions.
Can you go to your slides?
Yeah.
The one with the population, the different colors of blobs.
Yeah, the map.
The map of blobs. I don't know.
It is a cartoony map.
Population.
It's not a
breeding spots.
Spawning ground.
Oh yeah. Right. Sorry, I'm just going as slow as possible right now.
Yes.
We have an hour.
My question is,
thank you for coming. Thank you.
You're Mexican.
Yes.
I know, it's really hard to get up. The Mexican population that's in peril, I guess is the word to use.
It's listed as threat.
Threat. The one that you're going to make Southeast a designated area for.
What do you do?
Where do they...
These guys are getting scared.
Where do they be?
Yeah, they're listening in.
Are they... Can they call into the line?
Did you guys call in?
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Just call in.
I can give you the phone number.
Are you online?
Or they could just... we could put the speaker up to your phone.
Here they can ask a question.
As long as it's captured in the record, it's fine.
Right. So I got a guy in Ketchikan that says there's a group of them listening, and for some reason they want to mute their line.
Okay, operator, there appear to be some people that are on the line with you that do want to make a comment.
You bet, Russell.
So let me know if it's resolved.
Would you like me to open the line?
Yes, and then can you instruct them to say their name, and then I will let them know when their 5 minutes is up?
Okay,
I'm sorry. We'll just have to go back to... We'll go back to taking comments.
Yeah, on the record.
Yeah. The microphone.
So, yeah, no, we can't hear the... Is this not on speaker?
It is on speaker.
It is, yeah.
So can you just let me know when the first speaker is going? Because we are not hearing anything. Operator?
Yes. Okay, thank you. This is Ketchikan. We have several questions or comments.
Go ahead, please.
My name is Dick Coos here in Ketchikan, and I got a couple of questions, and then I've got a comment. The first question is...
Let's do them separately. Let me know when you're giving your comment, please, because we need to capture it on the record so the agency has that to consider. Questions are... separate.
Okay, I'll split them up between them. The question is, we've talked mostly tonight about the effect on fishermen and fishing, which is very important, but there's other activities that are going to go on in these critical areas, such as moving freight, moving cruise lines, and a number of other things. And are you going to tell us that it's not going to have any effect on them the same way you've told us it's not going to have any effect on the fishermen?
So I didn't fully hear the question, but if I restate it, you can let me know if I got it wrong. You're asking whether some of these other activities that are taking place in Southeast Alaska, like cruise line, like whale watching cruises, and just vessel traffic in general, if those are going to be affected by the critical habitat designation?
Yeah,
Is that your question?
Yeah.
So where there is a federal, where there's some kind of federal involvement in those activities, yes, they would be required to consult on whatever federal agency is involved would be required to consult on those. But for the bulk of vessel traffic, that's probably not the case. We don't consult on every single kind of vessel traffic. The main vessel consultations we do, they're ancillary to the larger federal action. So if BOEM is, if someone's building a new oil platform, there's going to be some vessel activity involved with that, and that's part of that consultation on building that oil platform that a BOEM activity is involved with. So I don't, the day-to-day vessel traffic that you're probably talking about, there isn't a federal connection. For Southeast Alaska, when we looked back at the historical consultation record, there is a lot of vessel traffic related to Forest Service activities.
You know, the feds regulate everything that goes through these waters, the cruise ships, the oil tankers, everything. They're talking to them. So anyway, that's kind of a question. The other question is, if there's no effect, then why are we wasting money doing this? Is it tricky, the lawsuit, like one gentleman said earlier? You're settled a lawsuit with the nutcases in California?
Yeah, so we do have a lawsuit, you're absolutely correct, and you're...
Are you still there?
Yeah, can you not hear me? Can you hear me?
No, we couldn't hear you
now
back.
We can.
Okay, so, yeah, so critical habitat is required anytime we list a species under the Endangered Species Act. And just because some of the activities that currently take place that we would consult on because they're federal activities, just because we're not foreseeing a change in those activities because of the critical habitat, it doesn't give us an out. It doesn't mean we're somehow off the hook in terms of the legal requirement to designate critical habitat. It simply means that for a lot of cases, for a lot of the activities that we're doing, there's already a lot of requirements in place to avoid harming or disturbing the listed whales or affecting their habitat. And we heard a good example of that from a gentleman this evening who talked about all the restrictions that are already in place when he does pile driving. So when you talk about adding critical habitat to the mix, there's already so much going on that it's not going to, you know, add to what's already happening. For what we've reviewed in our consultation history and for what we know about for the plan next 10 years to be happening in these areas. I definitely would say that there is still a value to designating critical habitat. We're required to do it, so we have to do it. But then the added value that can be non-regulatory are things that we talked about earlier in the presentation, like it could focus research efforts where we need them. It can help other managers identify where the really important habitats are and things like that. And just the mere fact that federal agencies are now like put on notice that these are areas where they're gonna have to consult on critical habitat does make them look a little bit more closely at their activities and consider potential mitigation things that they could build into their activity up front. So it does, that is hard to capture in an analysis or articulate, but that does happen, and that's just our experience doing Section 7 on projects, and that's basically what we see as the benefit of critical habitat.
Thank you. Now I'll make a comment rather than a question.
Okay, comment now.
I'll repeat my name, Dick Coos in Ketchikan. I've lived in Southeast Alaska for only 40 years, so I'm a newcomer. But my background is not fishing. I'm a forester by trade. My son-in-law and grandson are commercial fishermen. And my experience in working with the federal government over those years has been you take and designate critical habitat. I watched the Forest Service do it. It destroys an industry. And I'll guarantee you, the fishermen just stepped into the waters. you give them time, and the federal government, under the regulatory agencies, and the nutcase environmentalists, and if we don't fix the Ninth Circuit, there won't be a commercial fisherman. There'll be a lot of wild fish out there, but there won't be any commercial fishermen, just like there's no loggers anymore. So I would encourage you not to designate this habitat, period. I would encourage everybody to talk to the federal delegation and go after President Trump and stop this regulatory nonsense. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Okay, thank you.
We have another question.
Yeah, thanks for putting on this show. We have been listening, a bunch of us here in the room, but my question is, it's 2% of a whale population. Does anybody know the number of whales involved?
So the current abundance estimate, or one of the most recent ones, is about 2,800, but there are different, and that's plus and minus confidence intervals, of course, and then there's different abundance estimates out there, but that's a good ballpark number to use for the Mexico DPS.
That's the one population.
Other.
Is that 2% of 2,800?
Correct. But there, so, you know, and the 2% is coming from the Wade 2017 analysis. There's other percentages floating out there, like up to 8.5%. So take your pick.
Okay, may I make a comment, please? Russ Cockrum still.
Okay, yep. Please go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, I'd just like to go on the record. I've been commercial fisherman in Southeast Alaska for 44 years continuously. In the beginning, it's like all those folks from Petersburg said, there was very few whales. Now it's beyond ridiculous. And I don't know how this process got started, but it falls into the same verbiage. It's ridiculous also. So thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to ask the question. We have another question. Hi, this is Katie Montgomery, and I'm in Ketchikan, and I've been a resident here for 54 years.
Let's see if they're still here.
Are you
still here?
Are you making a comment, or are you just asking a question right now?
No.
I'm sorry, are you,
hello?
Katie, are you asking a question right now, or would you like to make a comment?
That ridiculous comment.
Ridiculous. What operator? This is why I paid for this. Sorry, I think it was Katie. You wanted to go ahead and make a comment or ask a question? I think you may have muted everyone. Operator?
Can you hear us? This is Ketchikan.
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, we have another question, please.
Did you get my comment?
If you're not asking a question, could you please mute your own line or just please stop talking?
Yes, we are going to do that. Did you get Russell Cockrum's statement?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Now we have another question.
Hi, my name is Katie Montgomery here in Ketchikan. I've been an Alaska resident for 54 years. And I just wanted to clarify the question that Mr. Coos had asked at the beginning. For the critical areas, what effect do you see could happen with our barge companies, the cruise line companies, our state ferries, as he had mentioned, oil rigs? I didn't really fully understand your response.
Yeah, so I, you know, so you're asking about a lot of different types of vessel traffic, and for the most part, I'm not aware that there's a federal nexus for these generic uses that you're talking about. So it's a little hard for me to answer. If there is no federal permit or authorization for these vessels, and they're not involved in a federal activity, then there's no Section 7 issue. There's no critical habitat issue. There's no reason that the critical habitat would affect those boats. For the most part, you know, people talk about whale watching. unless those boats are operating in like a national park where there's particular regulations, federal regulations that affect them, we're not consulting on those activities. And then when we do consult with like National Park for Glacier Bay whale watching, it's on a very programmatic level. We don't consult every time a boat is moving. It's done at a very programmatic level, and it covers the whole set of regulations that are dictating how those boats operate in Glacier Bay. So I don't know if there's anything specific you would add.
Specific whale watching?
Or vessels in Southeast Alaska that we're consulting on?
Yeah, also just acknowledging that the features of prey and how that would be connected to vessel traffic. You know, that is a challenging connection to make. The impacts to individual whales because of vessel presence are already being evaluated. That has been ongoing for decades.
So Katie, I don't know if you heard that, but Susie is just pointing out that it's, again, with the critical habitat and consultations on critical habitat, it gets at what those analyses are going to look at is the effect of the particular activity on the critical habitat, and in particular that prey feature that we're designating. So if the vessel traffic isn't really going to have an effect on prey, there's no issue. Just setting aside the whole question of, do you even have a federal relationship there? Is there a federal nexus? So hopefully that helps answer the question a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Are there more comments? Yes? Okay, we do have another question.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Eric Tyson. So I'm wondering, how old is this data that you're basing everything on, the whale populations?
So there's, I don't know, well over 100 references that we used in the analysis. So that's not an easy question for me to answer. I think at the root of a lot of what we know about humpback whales does date back to that splash study, which is definitely dated at this point, but the statute doesn't require that we go out and do new studies. We're held to designating critical habitat based on the best available data. What we're looking for during the public comment period is there anything new or different that we should be considering that would affect how we've done what we've done so far? So you've heard from a lot of people that have talked about their concerns about what we've done, but unless we get specific information that leads us to look at something in particular, it's very hard for us to take action. So we are looking for information, input that can help us have the most robust analysis possible for the final rule.
So what you're telling me is you're using old data. Right now you don't know if the populations, this critical Mexican population of whales, is increasing or decreasing or has stayed the same?
Yeah, I am saying that for the entire North Pacific, the splash study is old. Is that the only thing we looked at? Absolutely not. You heard somebody mention tonight that Glacier Bay National Park Service has the longest running whale photo ID study out there. We absolutely, not only did we talk to those individual researchers, but we used their data. So that's up to date, finger on the pulse of what is going on in Glacier Bay. And where we have that information, we absolutely used it. If we missed something, we definitely want to know about it. But just, I think if you do talk to people that have been studying humpback whales for years, they will tell you that the patterns indicated by the splash study, albeit old, are the patterns that we still understand to be correct today. So, meaning where are the whales moving, what's their basic structure of the populations, and what's their status. That information is still pretty good today, even though it is old. I would absolutely love to be able to wait a couple years and see what new stuff comes out of this new analysis that's going on, but we don't have that luxury. We do have the opportunity under, you know, to revise critical habitat. We do that routinely. We just put out a proposed rule to revise southern resident killer whale critical habitat. So when new information does become available, we do have that ability. So this isn't set in stone forever and ever more, critical habitat for humpback whales.
We've given you a tremendous amount of information. We told you that from the 80s, 90s, and in the 2000s, the population here in Southeast has increased tremendously. I mean, how many of you, you can go to Frederick Sound, and I can look straight in Frederick Sound, and this is in July, and I will see 100 spouts in just one. It's not what's happening around me, it's what's happening in front of me. So what more information do you want out of us? We've given you that the population has grown.
So I'll check in with the phone in a second. But
I apologize.
I think what is complex in Alaska is the fact that, and people have mentioned this again tonight, that you have mixing of non-listed, non-ESA listed, Hawaiian breeding population of humpback whales that come into Alaska waters to feed. And those whales look exactly the same as the threatened Mexico humpback whales. So those whales are sharing the same feeding grounds and they're mixing. And across the North Pacific, the population trend is on the uptick. There are a few caveats to that though, so don't
So what is the carrying capacity in Southeast Alaska?
I don't have that. That has not been.
And are the Western Pacific whales keeping forage fish from the Mexican DPS?
So the distribution, and I'll get back to the phone in one second. The distribution of the Western North Pacific whales. So those whales feed off of the coast of Russia and then into the Aleutian Islands. And as you move across eastward, across the Gulf of Alaska, their distribution really tapers off.
Or the wired ones.
And yeah. So the Mexico whales, as this woman rightly pointed out, there is a weirdness to what those whales are doing. Some of them are heading to the West Coast, out to Washington, Oregon, California, and some of them are shooting across the Pacific Ocean and headed to Alaska. And so there is this diversity in where those whales are headed, and they show up all over the place. So, there is overlap of those whales, and they have a simplistic distribution as the Western North Pacific. You see a lot of whales, Mexico DPS whales around the eastern Aleutians, and then they do taper off as you head across the Gulf of Alaska and into British Columbia, and then there's an uptick of them again as you head southward along the west coast of the U.S. down towards Southern California. So it's not a simplistic pattern. It's definitely.
But the growth of the Western or of the Hawaiian population is keeping feed from the Mexican population, but they're intermingling with in Southeast Alaska.
Are they keeping feed from?
Well, I mean, there's only so much. So you're talking about forage fish.
You're asking things I can't answer, and not only should I not answer those for you tonight, but they're not necessarily informative of it. Whether these whales are competing with each other doesn't tell me anything about
whether. You don't know the carrying capacity, but how can you determine whether or not...
Where their essential features are and where they're occurring? I don't know that we've ever determined carrying capacity in order to do a critical habitat designation.
It's a legitimate question because when any population eats itself out of house and home, that's what happens to that population. You just didn't know it.
So critical habitat, the purpose of critical habitat is to support the recovery of listed species. So the presumption, of course, if they're listed and they're facing extinction now or in the foreseeable future, they're not at carrying capacity. It's not a relevant question right now. Carrying capacity would be a relevant question if we're looking at delisting them. Have they met recovery metrics? Should we get them off the endangered species list? That's what we're trying to do right now, right? We're trying to get them to that point of recovery. And
so what is sustainable?
One tiny tool in that.
What do you consider as a sustainable population for the Mexican population?
So I don't have an answer
per year.
You're at 2,800
animals. You're asking me to basically predict the outcome of a recovery planning process that is yet to happen.
What if it's already happened? What if that is the carrying capacity of that specific DPS?
It wouldn't be listed. So you guys are asking questions that are not, you've got to keep this focus on critical habitat and asking me questions about this rule. Don't get into questions about the listing. We're not here to re-adjudicate the listing of the whales. That's not anything that is open for public comment right now. They're listed, okay? Western North Pacific is listed as endangered. Mexico is listed as threatened. This is the situation we're in right now. Now we're talking about critical habitat. So, yes, the phone. Thank you for reminding me.
Ketchikan, comments or questions, please.
Anyone on the phone have a question or comment?
Yeah, so this is Ketchikan. We have a couple more questions.
Okay.
Hi, this is Lacey Simpson in Ketchikan. I had a couple of questions for you. Number one, in talking about the limited population originating in Mexico, what work is NOAA doing internationally in terms of preserving or increasing these populations? Are they working with Canada? Are you working with Mexico? Are you working with other areas and other nations that have waters in which these whales travel in?
Yeah, so we participate in international work through the IWC process, the International Whaling Commission. But those kinds of questions you're asking about working with foreign countries on recovery in outside of U.S. jurisdiction, again, not relevant to this process because we can't designate critical habitat in foreign waters. But just to answer your question, because we're here, those are the kinds of things that could feed into a recovery plan. We have an old recovery plan for humpback whales. It needs to be updated because of the change in the listing. We need specific recovery actions and metrics for the three for these DPSs, as well as the two that are entirely foreign. And so we would use that process to identify what kinds of things could be doing with Mexico, Panama, Guatemala, Canada, Japan, Russia, et cetera. So that's where that becomes a relevant topic in the recovery plan process. We're gonna do the phone for a little bit, sorry, and we'll come back. Anyone else on the phone have a question?
Thank you. This is still Lacey Simpson in Ketchikan. I had another question. Can you tell us a little bit about the timeline for this proposed rule after the comment period has closed? What are the next steps, and when is it anticipated that this rule would go into effect?
Sure. So after the close of the comment periods, we'll be working on developing a final rule. What that's going to entail is going to depend on the scope and nature of the public comments, and I guarantee you the most significant ones are going to come in on January 31st. So I won't really know what's going to be involved, but I can give you a general timeline that I've kind of mapped out for us to meet our deadline, and that's to kind of have a final rule developed by early May, because then there's a very lengthy review process that takes place for these rules. In order to get all those clearances and review processes done and meet the January 28th, I guess the 28th, 2020 deadline for having a final rule submitted to the Federal Register, it's kind of, we're looking at May to have something wrapped up. And then you should see a final rule in the Federal Register either late September or early October, and there's usually like a 30-day period after which the rule would go into effect. So you're looking at a final rule going into effect in early November 2020. Just ballparking.
Sorry, I think I may have misheard you. Did you say that you'd be composing the final rule for submission to the Federal Register around January 28th, but the comment period on the proposed rule as it stands today is not until the 31st of January?
No, I either said something wrong or you misheard me, but no, the comment period is open till January 31st. After that, we'll develop the final rule. And just
mapping out the timeline on that and backing up what has to get done before the end of September 2020, I'm predicting we need to have all of our documents in ducks in a row by early May, because there's a lengthy clearance process that has to happen through the federal agency, and there's interagency comment, OMB review, all this other stuff that takes place. Then the rule gets submitted to the Federal Register, which publishes it. That has to happen by the end of September 2020. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, are there questions on the phone?
Is it time? I got a question about
let me just clear. I don't, it doesn't sound like there's anything. And then there was a gentleman in the back that's been waiting. All right, I'm not hearing anything on the phone, so let's.
Okay, well, I'm Kurt Walker. I'm sorry that I wasn't here from the whole meeting. I was here at the beginning, and then I just came back. What sort of plans have you guys already got in the books for this recovery of these whales? What's your intentions of how to recover them? And once you guys identify that, you know, they need to, somehow recover. Even though in the early 20s and 30s, we were harvesting whales here. You know, to nearly extinction, and now we got 2,800 of them. And we had herring reduction plants everywhere. So what, as you, as a human, are going to do to recover these whales for us? So, thank you.
So that, again, I'm going outside the bounds of what I'm supposed to be talking about tonight. That's a recovery planning process. Recovery planning has not been started yet. The solution is still fairly new for us. It takes quite a while to get all these different things done. When we do recovery plans, we do develop them with a big team, where we bring in lots of different people to help develop those, because so what you're talking about is yet to be done. And I can just tell you from experience, they typically are pretty involved. We try to get a lot of input, because recovery plans are not specific to just NOAA fisheries or any one federal agency. The things that go into a recovery plan involve lots of different partners and activities and things that lots of other entities could be undertaking outside of just what NOAA fisheries can do. So that's why we have to bring a lot of input and a lot of people to the table to work through development of a recovery plan. I can't answer that for you. It's not done yet. That's on the horizon.
So on that comment, your own impact study, dollar-wise, is
huge.
It's out to lunch. You're not even realistic.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The 87, what was over 10 years? What was
the cost of administrative changes?
I'm not understanding how that relates to what I was just saying.
Well, your economic impact.
Did you have to be ready for the recovery?
So when you form this plan, moving forward, let's say you're going to form a plan, are you going to reach out to your groups and involve us in the process?
I am not here to talk about recovery planning. That's a totally separate process. I'm not involved with that. I'm not here to talk about that. That has nothing to do with this critical habitat rule. I absolutely wish we had a recovery plan, because usually a recovery plan will map out the kinds of things you guys are asking about. What's the carrying capacity? What are we trying to get these populations up to? What are the numbers that we want? When will we hit recovery? What's the timeline for that? What's the cost to get there? What are the things we want to do to get there? Who are the federal or the international partners we want to work with? Those are all questions that I'm not here to answer. It has to do with recovery planning. That is a big process. Who is going to participate? I don't know yet. I'm not in charge of that. That's not within what this public hearing is about or what I can even answer. If you're interested in that, definitely contact me. We can talk about that another time. I can put you in touch with who is going to be tapped as the lead for that effort. If you want to stay engaged, that's fantastic. But that's not what this hearing is about right now. I wish I had answers for you. I don't.
Well, the main reason you're here is because the feds got sued by this diverse whoever.
Center for Biological Diversity. You had a question.
That's the main reason there. Mm-hmm.
So my question is that, so you have the five metrics that you use to determine conservation ratings and economic impact. One of the metrics couldn't be applied to Southeast Alaska. Two of the metrics use a different DPS than the one targeted, but we have this database from Glacier Bay that is huge, that shows the reproductive capacity that has occurred over the last 30 years and the percent annually and and the number of years that they can calve for and the years they calve for and how long they live. Why can't we use some of this information and apply it to, this is what happened with them, why wouldn't the same rebound take place with the Mexican whales?
So I think your comment that you gave earlier is great because it was specific and you did touch on some of these things. So Chris Gabriel and the person running that whole, she was heavily involved with this process. We absolutely looked at her data. If you, it looks like, or it sounds like from what your comments you gave, you've been looking closely at the documents, which is greatly appreciated because when you give specific input like that, you can address it. You said specific things about specific information you looked at. So that's very helpful. It allows us to revisit that and change, make changes where necessary. But so I'm just going to kind of leave it at that. But I think it'd be good for you to know that we absolutely use the data available to us from that study. Chris was a peer reviewer for us. I still talk to her about what's going on. She keeps me up to date with what's going on. She has a couple important papers out that talk about the importance of that area and actually what's going on with the drop in calving rates and the drop in returns of whales that they've been seeing for decades that are no longer returning. So there's a lot of information like that that she's been providing, and we absolutely will continue to do that.
Thank you. Hi, this is the conference operator. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The line got quiet.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, you couldn't hear the room. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure everyone's there.
Yep, and if anyone on the phone wants to ask a question or make a comment, just let me know.
No, we can't be done yet.
You guys are the diehards, so.
I got a question. It's probably irrelevant to this, but through this data and information gathering of this Mexican population and this Hawaiian population and whatever these populations, has anybody ever noticed any of these populations crossing over and hooking up with this gal from that pod? And now we're over here and we're not going to Mexico anymore. I'm going to Hawaii. I like it there better.
So
is there any data to that?
Absolutely. I think what you're asking, though, is about the structure of the DPS.
That would have dropped this person from that population, and now the Census Bureau says they're over here. Has that ever been looked at?
Absolutely. We talk about that in our draft biological report. So where we get that information from is photo ID matches. So where a whale is identified to the actual individual whale and it's photo ID'd in, say, Hawaii, and then it's photo ID'd in Mexico, that is movement of a whale between breeding areas. So those kinds of movements have been documented, so they occur, but what their biological meaning is, meaning are those whales actually mating with whales of a different breeding population, is an open question in the sense that we don't actually understand how much that is occurring. Now, what we do have is genetic data. So the genetic data, what those are telling us is there are significant genetic differentiations between these breeding populations, which does indicate that for the most part, these whales are not mixing, that they're not interbreeding. So that's the understanding based on the genetic data we have.
But maybe, you know, there's this carrying capacity is met. So now these have moved over here because genetics are getting too deep over here.
We need to intermix. Then you wouldn't get genetic differentiation of the populations. Right. So they would be one population.
So it's low occurrences and it's in both directions that have been documented.
They'll hang out with a municipal feeding unit.
Like what? 2% maybe?
That's what they say at Keto's.
Some of this is discussed in the scientific literature. None of it is 100% clear cut. You have to do the best you can with what you know.
It's just kind of hard to take that we're getting this crammed down our throat off of a lawsuit instead of data.
Well, this gentleman is saying we're only doing it from a lawsuit. I don't want you going around town saying we're only doing this because of a lawsuit, because if you remember from my presentation, we are required, when there is a listing under the Endangered Species Act, there is no out button for designating critical habitat. When you list a species, you have to designate critical habitat to the maximum extent prudent and determinable. So that is dictated by the Endangered Species Act itself, not because CBD sued us. Sued us because we missed our deadline for getting this done.
Prudent, what is that?
Prudent means like...
I know what it means.
Yeah.
It requires judgment as well.
Right, so we have regulations that speak to when it's not prudent, and we have to comply with those regulations also.
So we never argue that 2% for a couple of months.
This is a done deal. No. We're just going through the motions here.
Well, if you want to say that, I would say that's not helpful to me. Yeah.
Do you know who Tony Heller is?
So I would say this woman here who read the documents, you're like my model commenter because you gave very specific comments about things we looked at and things we did. Comments on how we did what we did are helpful to us moving forward. Comments like, we don't like it. What would I do with that?
Well, it's hard to listen to you say it's not relevant, that we don't know what the carrying capacity is. We're the ones watching the feeding. I mean, we see so many whales feeding so long, so much. I mean, when they run out of feed, they're going to die.
That is why, again, that's why we mentioned earlier that why it's hard here, because you have the mixing of non-listed Hawaiian DPS whales, that their abundance is far and away greater than the two listed whales that also occur in in Alaska. So the Hawaiian whale population is like 11,000. You've got an endangered Western North Pacific population that's about 1,000 whales. That's an order of magnitude difference. And then the Mexico whales are about 2,800, right? So combined, those two listed populations are still a tiny fraction of those non-listed Hawaiian whales. And so we do want to tease apart what we know about the listed ones and ignore what we know about the Hawaiian ones, because we're not designating critical habitat for them. Those whales are there, but they're not listed under the Endangered Species Act. We cannot designate critical habitat for them. This habitat is not being designated for them.
Very frustrating. You're looking for specific information, but they don't have Mexican flags on them or anything.
Right.
We just see a lot of whales.
Yep. I hear you.
What you want us to do is to start taking pictures of whales so we can start telling you which whale is which. Is that kind of what you...
No, I'm not expecting... I think the kind of input that you guys are bringing is things like what we may have missed in terms of economic impacts, and some people talked about that tonight. Those are people talking about, I'm the user group. That's how you're viewing this rule and how you think it's going to impact you. Do we underestimate costs and things like that? Those are the kinds of comments I was expecting from you guys. I'm not expecting you to come up with scientific data and tell me where the whales are moving. No, I'm not asking for that.
You've grossly underestimated the value of our way of life and our fisheries and how we live and how we keep these small communities alive in the wintertime.
So
but you're willing to say that it's worth $72 to every taxpayer in the United States so that these whales are out there. I mean, it's just your data is collected apples and oranges based on what industry you're looking at. We feel like ours got the short stick here.
Yeah, so I think that in addition to any comments you made tonight, if you want to submit additional comments, get on regulations.gov and put that, you submit an electronic comment about underestimation of costs and why. And if you can be specific as possible, that is helpful to us. We certainly don't intend to undervalue anything or anyone. And there is a part of the economic analysis where we're required under the boring Regulatory Flexibility Act to look at effects on small businesses. So that's where we do even get more like in depth in terms of what the economic impacts are. And there may be a different way of looking at things or presenting things that aren't in there that you may want to tell us about. And that helps us improve our, you know, supporting documents for the for this rule. So that's what we would be looking for. And if you can provide that, that's, we definitely appreciate it.
You know, the reason our hackles go up is because Glacier Bay, we got kicked out of there in 97, I think was the year, 96. Except for a few guys got their rights to fish crab in there and do their thing, halibut. They got, and they got paid. The spotted owl, you know, that's why our hackles go up. There's lots of things the federal government has done to different industries that's why we, the little slide where you showed you had comment towns, you had Anchorage and Petersburg now, or you did one in Juneau?
Oh, for public, where public we did public comment. Hearings?
Yeah.
Yes, we had one in Juneau.
And you weren't even going to do this one until we finally screamed in our city council, asked you guys to come?
I don't know that that's a fair characterization of what happened. So when we published... So as the person who planned all the public hearings, no, it's not.
Okay, it was planned early on?
No, so what we did was, so we have a massive geographic area to cover. We picked a location, two in Alaska, but one location in all the other states, one in Washington, one in Oregon, one in California, and two in Alaska. And we set those hearings up, and what you do when you publish a proposed rule is you say, if anyone would like to have a public hearing, please submit a request within 45 days. And that's the process. We got a request from Petersburg. We waited to see if there anything else came in. We got a request from Ketchikan that originally said, hey, we support the request from Petersburg. If you can't have it in Petersburg, have it in Ketchikan. We got that request and we said, okay, let's Petersburg it is. And then we got a later request from Ketchikan just recently, and that's why we've made this.
Sure.
We don't normally have remote access to hearing, but we wanted to provide that to those people that wanted to listen in and make comments. So we definitely did everything we could within the time we had, with the resources we had, and I think we're very responsive to Petersburg requests. I am here right now.
Yep.
So let's not get it twisted.
Well, I won't twist it up too much, but the distrust is earned, and it's earned over the decades and generations. And, you know, we're all trying to make it, and we aren't, you know. Anyway.
I hear you. I hear you. And I'm
studies on how many wells are here.
They're already covered.
Yes. So
you're going off old data.
2017. Okay. Yeah. Excuse me. Let me. Maybe I can clarify some things here. I think maybe the reason why we're so passionate about what we're talking about here is that you keep referring to us as small businesses, but we're not small businesses. This is our lifestyle.
No, small.
No. Hold it.
Yeah.
Let me finish. This is what we do for a living. This is our passion. This is what we do. And now we have some government entity coming in here telling us that we're going to start monitoring and putting in these areas, you know, that night. I think what we're trying to do here is get the nose of the camel into the tent. That's what you're doing. And so you don't think we're not going to be impassioned about this? Of course we are. So
all right, you guys, let's not put words in my mouth.
Just remember that this is what we do for a living.
Absolutely.
And this is our lifestyle. This is who we are. Now take your identity away from you and tell me how you would feel about what you're doing.
So, okay. Anyone else?
For being here, by the way.
Yes, in the back. And then I'll get you, too. In the back.
Just enough, I feel very outnumbered. And so I appreciate you coming here and listening to our public comments. From fishermen and for those of us who are right online who didn't get a chance to talk. I want to say that thankfully. And as a marine biologist, so why I feel outnumbered. And as a third generation fisherman, so from that out right now, probably, I span the gap for both and I hear both concerns on both parties with a lot of distrust, like 100%. I've seen my family suffer. I've seen my grandfather and my dad, and now me suffer and have to find it through careers. So, but I've also now been educated, and now I'm trying to make a new career in biology. So it's a hard walk, a hard line to walk. And I hear the distress. I have a lot of it. But I also hear the positive attempts, and so I would like to see more active research on both parties. So from the scientists and from a maybe not so big federal government, but state also. The state can't ignore this too, and just say, well, the feds can deal with it, right? State pointed out these are in Alaska, these are Alaskan waters. That's our state. So maybe we should be also looking at our state to do something and just saying, well, the feds, we distrust them. So what then, what can we do? Because this, the whales aren't going to go anywhere. We have to be work with them. And so I appreciate you coming and listening. And I appreciate everyone in this room for saying what I didn't have the bravery to stand up and say for my own family. So thank you.
I think someone was
I just have one concern was when you were talking about economics here, when you put this into effect, which it sounds to me like, regardless of what we say about it or concern about it, it's going to go into effect. And when it goes into effect, you are laying the path platform for our for other entities to be able to come in here and pressurize our state fisheries leaders into making rules and regulations that are going to affect us economically. So what you're doing is going to affect us economically.
Is there any industries that are exempted from this?
No, I mean, just again, to emphasize, critical habitat only affects federal action. So if you're talking about something that's a private activity, there's no effect of critical habitat.
For sure.
So
yeah, that's the one thing, that's the one thing that I was wondering about. I mean, we've had long-standing commercial fishermen, we've watched whale populations blossom over the last 40 years while we've had, you know, through statehood. Can we be exempted from the critical habitat? Any impact from the critical habitat?
So the only exemption process, and if that's not technically the correct word, but the only way to sort of not have critical habitat applied is the 42 exclusion process, where we look at the impacts of a critical habitat designation and weigh them against the conservation benefit of the designation. And through that process, that gives us an out. So if there's an impact, an economic impact, a national security impact, or some other kind of relevant impact that relates to the rule we're talking about, not to other things, but to the rule we're talking about, the critical habitat, if those impacts outweigh the conservation benefit of having that critical habitat for that species, then we can exclude an area. So we can exclude areas.
You can't exclude an activity.
Not that's activities, right. Right. The law does not allow for exclusion of activities, but it does allow for the exclusion of areas from the critical habitat, and we do it through that 42 process.
And the impact has got to be a federal impact.
It has to be right. An impact. It can't be an impact. So if it's an impact of the critical habitat, you're absolutely right. It's because of it affects some federal activity. Not because it affects cruise ships. Cruise ships have, you know, it depends on what we're talking about specifically, but I didn't see any consultations on cruise ships per se for Southeast Alaska. I don't know us doing that. So I don't know what we're talking about with that. I know for the only vessel stuff that I think I remember seeing in the consultation records are Forest Service. It was specifically a vessel traffic, was Forest Service moves logs about, and so we have to consult on that. It's a federal activity, and that's always been a ship strike issue for humpbacks, not a habitat prey-related impact. You're making a face that makes it sound like you're not, well, look no, like you're I'm not just, following
I'm,
me.
I'm just, no, I guess I do, I mean, but it just seems like I mean, the vessel strikes, I mean, it's noted in somewhere in that vast array of supporting documents that we've been mulling through, that, I mean, ship strikes are...
Right, but so...
Number one, it's the biggest, it take...
Yeah, and the...
Taker that could, I mean it's, it wouldn't have an impact, the... Yeah, I mean, if the Mexican whale population went down because 20 of them got hit by cruise ships,
tankers,
how would that impact critical habitat and our activities?
Right, it doesn't.
Because we
get
an exemption, we get takes.
So, yeah, you probably have something better to say than me, so I'll let you talk. But so whales are, all of the humpback whales are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Somebody earlier was talking about IHAs, incidental harassment authorizations. Those are done under MMPA, and those don't just affect federal activities. They affect everything. That's MMPA. That's nothing to do with critical habitat under the ESA. So things that different... And that's, again, why I keep saying the baseline protections are really high already for these whales, so that the critical habitat isn't going to add much over and above what's already taking place in terms of how you're changing what you're doing if it's a federal activity. You can't have both. You can't say we're already doing a ton and this is going to add more to it. It doesn't work that way with critical habitat. There's so much that we're already doing for these whales, including, as I mentioned earlier, the federal fisheries already prohibit, you know, harvest of their main prey. So we're already doing so much that it's not conceivable to think that you're going to do anything differently than what you're doing now as a result of a Section 7 consultation on this critical habitat for the majority of things we know about. Did you want to add to that?
No, I got a question though. Sure. I think we get X amount of takes a year, right? I'm a gill netter.
No, that's not the way it works. And I'm glad you asked. I'm the one who manages the list of fisheries.
Okay.
It doesn't work that big. So you're talking about a state managed fishery.
Absolutely.
Having a certain number of takes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. We got our exceptions.
So the negligible impact determination process authorizes a certain number of fisheries. Or a certain number of takes in a fishery, and that's separate from the state managed fisheries.
Then cruise ship takes.
Then cruise ship takes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's an entirely different process. So the cruise ships are not authorized to hit whales, and that happens. It's completely outside of anything to do with critical habitat. That is a take issue, which is both MMPA and ESA.
So those things exist with or without this rule. Those things are going to be in place.
Right.
This rule doesn't change that in any way. It doesn't make it worse. Doesn't make it easier.
So there's no federal nexus in our exemption. I mean, because you guys I talked to you both on the phone, I think, when this first kind of happened, and it was like...
That was you.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
You were talking about federal nexus. As long as we had no federal nexus, it was no big deal, but we have these exemptions. It's a federal exemption to marine mammals.
The exemption is MMPA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So, but, okay, it is federal. I mean, it's federal.
Right,
I mean,
it's a different act, though.
Yeah, okay, but it's a federal nexus.
Yeah.
And then the other question I had was about the treaty, because we have an international treaty.
For salmon.
That we get, yes, we do.
Yeah.
Here, that we get managed for heavily, us, and the same for the animal control treaty as well. And that will have no impact whatsoever. I mean, it doesn't, like, that's not a nexus.
So we have had one, that's a confusing legal question, so I'm not sure entirely, but we have had one consultation on the something change to the treaty. But in terms of, again, linking the salmon treaty and how that could be affected because of this critical habitat, there's no connection really. Humpback whales, yeah, they've shown up in their diet, and there's evidence that they've, like, targeted hatchery releases or something. But they're not coming here for salmon. It's not a major prey item. It's hard to fathom how that treaty or the function of salmon fisheries under that treaty would be altered because of this critical habitat. It's just, there's no basis to conclude that.
Nobody's ever seen whales skimming kelp, eating salmon fry?
No, there
it's
is.
Not documented?
Yeah, there's. We mentioned. Yeah. No. We've.
That's just a long time.
No, there's full discussion of that, where it has occurred in our biologic report. We're not. We're fully aware that there's been documentation. They've even swum up the Columbia River to eat salmon fry, but they're not there because of salmon traditionally. That's not a key prey item for humpback whales that they're targeting.
They got hungry routinely. Because there's nothing behind them. I mean, what, you know, it's back to how much herring are in Southeast. You know, the state of Alaska probably has that number from different fisheries that are gone now. So we're not fishing herring like we used to.
Which, again, has nothing to do with this rule. Somebody mentioned the closure of the Pacific cod fishery. Nothing to do with this rule. You know, if fisheries are closing, and that's happening, that trend's been going on.
It's confusing to us because you're closing. You're making.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
You're making an area to eat.
Thank you, everyone.
You don't really care. It's just confusing. I mean, it's just really...
So I just had a question to try to make it constructive for people who actually wanted to write something about economic impact. So we have a budding mariculture industry, especially in Southeast, but throughout Alaska, that is in its infancy, and it requires permits in
yep.
tidelands areas, and some of them have been given and some have not, and that is an economic boon that especially small communities are looking forward to as a buffer to the boom, you know,
yeah.
what we're feeling now. So that's a specific thing down the road that will be impacted economically by this ruling, but I can't give you numbers.
Right.
Can I just say we have this budding mariculture industry that hasn't been looked at as an economic impact?
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you exactly what you're writing in your comments,
no,
obviously,
but
sure. So look at the discussion. Yeah, look at the discussion in the report. We do talk about aquaculture. We did work with ADF&G to get information from them, some of which came too late. So I'm going to have to look back at that to see if we need to add some of that to what we've got in there. But yeah. Tell us to look at that, whatever you know about it, put that in your comment, but yeah.
Because it's in its infancy, and, you know, something like this, it wouldn't take much additional regulatory dollars to be heaped on top of it to just kill it, because it wouldn't be feasible any longer.
I do thank you for coming, sir. I was embraced of her.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I'm so glad you all came out. Makes it much more worthwhile having these.
Drawing the short straw to get this.
Thank you for coming. Thank you so much for participating.
Are we up the record?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. When you guys. I-